Hello and welcome back to Let the Stone Speak. I'm Brent Nuchtigal, the host of the program. I just got done interviewing Stephen Compton. He's a researcher that has recently published a paper describing a picture of Jerusalem. This picture dates from 2,700 years ago. It was drawn 10 feet high inside the throne room of the Assyrian king Sennacherib, the one that boasted that he held King Hezekiah in his royal city Jerusalem as a bird in a cage. Now, this paper was recently released in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies, the October 2025 edition. His article is entitled Sennacherib's Throne Room Reliefs on Jerusalem and the Misplaced City of Ushu. That article is behind a paywall. However, we have written up his research, summarized lots of his research in an article of our own as our feature story in our latest edition of Let the Stone Speak. This is a magazine that comes out six times per year for free. Wherever you are in the world, we'll send it to you. You simply need to go to armstronginstitute.org, scroll down and sign yourself up for the magazine, or you can write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org to make sure you get a copy of the magazine. We're also going to leave a link to both his scientific journal article and then our popular style article so that you can read up on everything we're discussing in this interview. Thank you very much for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you enjoy this content. But here's the interview with Stephen Compton. Stephen Compton, welcome back to our show.
Thank you, Brett. Great to be here.
So you've just published this blockbuster discovery, and I want to get to your proof about this Jerusalem scene that you found on Slab 28 in Sennacherib's palace, his throne room. But before we get to that scene, we have to talk about another couple of scenes that come before that. And this is what you write about in your paper. First of all, can you set up the scene, set up the throne room? What is kind of the idea of the throne room? What is on the walls? And then we can get down into the scenes that you discuss in your paper.
Sure. So Sennacherib had his accomplishments portrayed on the wall of his palace in these large stone slabs, intricately carved with scenes that stretched for some 2 miles along these walls of his palace. Extraordinary visual record provides us a lot of incredible windows into the world of the Iron Age of about 700 BC. And the most important room in that building by far, and the largest room ever excavated from ancient Assyria, was his throne room, 167 feet long. And the wall that we're interested in was the wall to the right of his throne, this long throne hall. To the right of his throne, he depicted his third campaign from 701 BC, his most famous campaign to this day, where he invaded first Phoenicia, then Philistia, then Judah, the famous invasion that ended up at Jerusalem. And also had a major conflict with Egypt during his invasion of Philistia.
So this is, as you said, the largest room ever excavated and found in ancient Assyria. In our article that we wrote on this, we talked about, and you called it prime real estate inside Sennacherib's palace. So you're describing this third campaign of Sennacherib. And it's part of your contention in your paper that the third campaign is recorded on this eastern wall. So what other scenes can be seen? Can they still be seen today? What were you using to base your study on?
So we had to use, or I had to use historical records. What was left of the reliefs was destroyed by ISIS. The room has been just smashed to pieces. It's very tragic.
Yeah.
Heidelberg University is attempting to piece it together like jigsaw puzzles, what's left, but it's been very, very much destroyed.
So you're saying that these stood in time for 2,700 years and then back 10 years ago, that's it.
What was left of them? There had been a series of... So in 612, when the Medes and Babylonians invaded, they burned the palace down. They sacked it and burned it. And so there's a lot of damage on the top from the burning. Mm-hmm. And so when they were excavated in 1849 and 1850 by Austin Henry Laird, some of the panels were somewhat intact and others were pretty badly damaged. And this is one of the issues I ran into in studying this, is that he only drew the best preserved panels and he just took notes on the gaps in between that were more badly damaged. And that, I don't know if I can skip ahead here, but the big mystery that got me going on this was there was this conflict over how to explain the first scene on the wall because it was incomplete knowledge. We had
Okay.
two scenes of Phoenicia, which was his first invasion of this campaign. And we know from his inscriptions as well that what happened was that they fled to sea. And we have this scene at Phoenicia of this city, I'm sure you can put it up, on the edge of the coast and these ships fleeing to sea. And it had always been assumed that that city that they were fleeing from was Tyre, but it was based only on the two panels that Laird had drawn. And William Gallagher in the 90s pointed out that Laird's notes describe these other panels to the side as depicting the city on the downslope of a mountain. He says the declivity of a mountain, the downslope of a mountain where it meets the sea. And he has another place where he talks about it being amongst mountains where they hit the sea, where they meet the sea. And Tyre, of course, is a small flat island with no mountains. So it clearly couldn't have been Tyre, but then nobody knew where it was. And Gallagher proposed Jaffa as an alternative, but Jaffa also lacks mountains. It also lacks forests, which Laird had described as in this image. And it's not in Phoenicia. So we had this kind of interesting unsolved mystery of what is the city, what's being
Right.
depicted. And
So if I could just zoom out one
sorry, yeah.
second before we jump into that, I just want people to realize, I mean, what we're talking about in these large reliefs they would have heard of the Lachish Wall reliefs. Just to give them a point of reference, these are in the British Museum right now. These are also found in Sennacherib's palace, but not in the prime real estate room of the throne room.
Yes.
So they're like that. They're very tall, perhaps around 3 meters, 10 feet. We don't really know the very top, I suppose, but at least what was preserved through the 90s, it was about that tall. And then you said there are written annals as well. So what we find on the wall reliefs, though, there's no labels, at least in the throne room, that we can see on these wall relief telling us this is this city, this is this city. But you have the written record in Sennacherib's annals preserved in many different forms that describe the third campaign. And so you're kind of matching that with what you see on the reliefs themselves. And then, since not all the reliefs were actually preserved and drawn, you're relying partially on the records of the archaeologist that first saw, discovered this, and wrote notes on the things that he didn't draw. Is that how
Yes,
we're
that's a
at?
good synopsis. Yes.
Okay, so you're talking about this first one then. Phoenicia is first in the annals on this journey of the third campaign, and everyone agrees that the first wall relief is Phoenicia, but you have a different interpretation on what that city was.
So one of the problems was that not everyone agreed that it was Phoenicia
Okay.
because Gallagher's theory was that it was Philistia. It was
Okay.
Jaffa. But most scholars had thought it was Phoenicia. The context is clearly Phoenician. But running into this issue with it not being Tyre and not knowing where it was, he proposed Jaffa because he said that it was the only city that we had a record of Sennacherib violently invading. That was his theory. That I think he's wrong about that. But I think there's evidence that Sennacherib also met resistance in Phoenicia and took captives in Phoenicia and so on. But yeah, I have a different theory. So this description of where a mountain or where mountains meet the sea is very specific. And most of Phoenicia, this area, especially southern Phoenicia, we have a specific list area where Sennacherib conquered. It's all this like strip of coastal plain all the way along the coast, except for right at what is now the Lebanon-Israel border on the Lebanon side, is this what's called the Ladder of Tyre, these two promontories where the Lebanon mountains came down to the sea. So it's the only place geographically that fits what we know of this image, of this scene. And Sennacherib lists the cities he conquered in order from north to south, and that area corresponds with the area that he where he lists the city of Ushu.
Like the city of Ushu.
The city of Ushu. Moreover, the city of Ushu is the only Phoenician city he labels on the entrance to his throne room. It's where he had his camp. It's where he summoned eight kings from far away to come and bring tribute to him. So he spent a lot of time at Ushu. And he had additional cities to the south of Ushu that he hadn't conquered yet, but he stopped and conducted his post-conquest diplomacy at Ushu, summoning other kings and so on, indicating this is where he triumphed. This is where he had his success, which I think is because this is where the Phoenicians fled, where the king had fled, and at that point he was in charge. Sennacherib was in charge. So
And so,
everything.
what you've done is you believe the city on the scene, on these two slabs is Ushu, the Phoenician city of Ushu, and you're able to place that in its location on this promontory or one of these promontories. And
Basically between the promontories.
so you've got the first city nailed down in your paper as being the Phoenician city of Ushu, and then the next city that was drawn, or the next, let's say, slab that was drawn in the throne room by Layard. What do you say about that?
So John Malcolm Russell solved this one. He's probably the foremost living expert on Sennacherib's reliefs, especially in the throne room reliefs. And he had photographed these just before ISIS, or shortly before ISIS destroyed them, before all the war and so on came to Iraq. And he recognized this as depicting, I don't know if you get the scene up, but it shows chariots in battle and then a camp at the top. And he recognized that this depicted the chariot battle that took place between the Assyrians and the Egyptians who came to save the Philistines, the save Philistia from Assyria. So that was the second kingdom that Sennacherib conquered, first Phoenicia, then Philistia. So at this point, we have them in order, which I think then is very important because it suggests that the third scene will then probably be the third kingdom he conquered, which is Judah.
So even before we actually see the image, the logical progression of the throne room would imply that Phoenicia's gone, Philistia's gone, Judah is next, and then there's one city that's preserved. And if you're going to preserve one city, you would probably preserve the capital in it. So then what we have, which is preserved in the drawings of Layard, is a gap of slabs that were undrawn. And then we finally get to slab 28, which is a beautiful scene. You can describe it for us.
So we have a single individual atop a tower inside a city that has not been conquered. So on so many levels, this is extraordinary in Assyrian art, because they would normally depict these cities being conquered, being broken open, being looted, being burned. And this city is inviolate, and you can see that in the back, the horsemen, Assyrian horsemen, going the other way, leaving the city intact. And you have the single individual on top. Normally they would depict soldiers with bows and arrows defending the city. This is really unusual, having only a single individual. And then he's holding up the standard, which is a symbol of royalty that the Assyrians frequently reference in conjunction with a king. They would capture a king and his standards, this kind of thing. The king's standards would go before him. So this seems to be a single king inside a city left intact, which is all of which is extraordinary, and which fits very well then with the inscriptions, because Sennacherib's inscriptions describing his conquest of Judah, or his attempt within at Jerusalem, he says, "I trapped Hezekiah in his city Jerusalem like a bird in a cage." And this seems to illustrate exactly what his text says: Hezekiah trapped in his city like a bird in a cage.
So as people see this and they are familiar with these references, we've of course known about the historic references of Hezekiah and Sennacherib, and then this famous scene. It parallels in many ways the biblical the Bible, it's which says in three different passages that he was unable to or didn't conquer the city of Jerusalem. And then you have this famous reference that you have described about how he was besieged and alone, like a caged bird in his royal city, it says. And so you have this image of how you touched on this, but how rare is it for these elements that you have in this picture? How, like, can you speak more to how unique this image is compared to other cities?
Yeah, I haven't found any other examples of, there's no other examples of a Ness standard, of a standard being held up by the defenders. I can't think of another example of a city just being left intact and the Assyrians leaving. I don't think there is any other example of that. Pretty much everything about this is really unusual. It's a very distinctive, there's a sort of program, a sort of a, kind of what you expect to see in all these reliefs, and it's always, the Assyrian army shows up, they conquer the city, they loot the city, they burn the city, and you see them walking away with treasure. The Lachish reliefs are a famous example. We've got them coming up on their ramp, conquering the city, and the other side, you've got captives being taken away and all the treasures being taken away from the city. And that's what that's what you almost always see. And this, so this is really unusual in every regard. It's completely unique.
And so you've talked about this a couple of times, this Ness idea of a standard. What is this word Ness that you're describing, for us?
So in Assyrian texts, they refer to a number of different kinds of standards in unusual forms, a globe, things like this. And in the Bible, it describes this standard called a Ness, which Ezekiel compares to a Phoenician sail. And in these reliefs, you can actually see a Phoenician sail, which is a centered beam, and then a sail, kind of square sail, hung on a centered pole with another horizontal cross beam. And it was exactly what you see in this relief. It looks exactly like what a Ness standard would be. So the standard itself is also equivalent, is also Judean. It's what you would expect Hezekiah to be holding up.
So one other interesting fact that you bring out is that you make a comparison of this image. So we have the relation of this one man, very unique, with a royal flag or standard bearing it. It looks like, if we're just going to face value it, hey, that's Hezekiah. but then there's more evidence that you can bring out. Not just the chronology as well of the images in the throne room with Phoenicia, Philistia and Judea. But then you talk about the similar architectural elements that you can see on this compared to some other reliefs.
Yeah, that was a pretty exciting find. When I looked at the architectural details of this image, it has these towers that go up and a rather sophisticated design where it then goes out from the base of the tower, a corbelled base for this room. The room comes up and you've got a second layer, which is again corbelled, and this battlement extends out over the room. So you get these twice corbelled towers, very sophisticated architecture. In other images from the West, we see single corbelled, where it comes out for a room, but nowhere else do we see double corbelled
And by the
except two.
West, you mean like the Levant area, Southern Levant.
Sorry, yes. The Phoenician scene, you can also see a single corbelled,
Okay.
and there are images of Philistine cities which also show single corbelled, but we don't have this upper battlement where it goes out again. So that upper battlement's unique to the Slab 28 image and Lachish, which we know is Judean, Judahite city. And then there's one other image. And when I looked at that one hadn't been identified, but has really unique water features around it. It has a moat across the front, but then on one side, the moat stops and there's a river. They don't connect, and there's a river running along one side. Clearly separating the two as two separate bodies of water. And that only corresponds with Tell us-Safi, where we've got a 2 kilometer extremely wide trench dug into the bedrock. And then on one side we've got a river. And the trench only wraps around three sides of the city. And then the river's on the other side.
So Tell us-Safi for our listeners, this is what has been designated as biblical Gath. So this is typically a scene or a city that belonged to the Philistines. But you're saying that based on the water features here, that it would be Gath, except we see architecture that is similar to Lachish and Slab 28.
And at this time, it was not Philistine.
Okay.
So the architect, the archaeological excavations of the site found that this was a Judahite occupation, a Judahite period at the site. Aaron Meyer's excavations there. And Sennacherib's inscriptions, the Azekah inscription, describes this as a Philistine city that Hezekiah had taken for himself. This was at this time a Judahite city possessed by Hezekiah. So the only two other examples besides Slab 28 that we have were with this unique architectural style were Judahite, which strongly suggests that the Slab 28 image is also Judahite, which was also suggested by its position in the chronology on the wall, as well as by the content of the image.
So this is remarkable. I think there's so much that is going to spring from the designation of this city in Slab 28 as Jerusalem, in parallel to the other cities that have already been designated, Lachish definitely as Judean, because you're now seeing this architecture emerge that we were never able to discern through archaeology, because very rarely, if ever, is a second story of a building, let alone a full tower, preserved from 2,700 years ago. And so, what did the top of the towers look like? We wouldn't have a clue. But now we are able, based on your research, I think putting this together, to say that this was a unique feature of Judean architecture, which for all of us, studying Judah for so long, to have this, open to us, it definitely changes a lot of our reconstructions that we would do of the ancient cities of Judah. Is there anything else in the image that you feel like is telling that it could be Jerusalem?
So something that was really interesting to me and kind of unusual, and this came a little bit out of our conversation at ASOR last year, where you asked me about how the image corresponded to the archaeology of Jerusalem, was that there's the back part of the image, the city, is set up on this separate ground level, the separate register from the city wall. And there's no other instance of an Assyrian city being shown on two separate registers or two separate ground levels like that. And we know that most likely the perspective that the Assyrians had was from the north. Josephus says that their camp was to the north. Isaiah 10 has them arriving from the north. And the layout of Jerusalem, the topography was such that you had valleys surrounding it on all the other sides, and the north side was always their most vulnerable. So if we're looking from the north, from the camp, from the image that the artist would have been looking at and that would have been most familiar to their clients, Sennacherib. What I think we're looking at there is this really unusual feature of Jerusalem where there was a trench between the Acropolis, the Temple Mount, and the City of David, the sort of original older city of Jerusalem, 30 to 35 meters across and 6 to 9.5 meters deep, this enormous trench dug through the bedrock. And the Assyrian artists tended to include the very distinctive features of a city. So at Gath, we have, okay, the moat stands out, they include the moat, things like this that stand out as unusual or distinctive. And so I think that this unusual split across two hills could also be a way of designating the city as Jerusalem.
Amazing. So this is what you would say for Slab 28. I do think it's interesting, just upon our conversations after reading your paper, also how many times the account of the third campaign, and specifically how many times Hezekiah is mentioned on the entrances to the throne room itself, and that, what do you think about that? It kind of makes sense that you would see an image of Hezekiah in Jerusalem, given that every time you entered the throne room, You're reading about this man.
Yeah, he specifically names only the Judean city of Jerusalem and only Ushu. And then when you walk in, you see what clearly appears to be Ushu and Jerusalem. He seems to have specifically labeled the cities that you're going to see inside the room or included them. Yeah.
So unfortunately, no one can go to Nineveh, ancient Nineveh, today and see this, but we do have the image of it and the drawing of it. We do have a photograph of it that was taken in 1990 from John Russell. So we've got the evidence is there, and it's just taken you to kind of fit it all together so that Jerusalem can live again after 2,700 years, and we can get a picture of it. I will say for people, in terms of Jerusalem's the layout, city layout, we have the Madaba map, which was found in Jordan, and this is from the Byzantine period. And I'm always amazed at how much people study into this map from the Byzantine period to get clues as to Jerusalem's the layout of Jerusalem. And this, yet what you've given us, is 1,000 years earlier than that, at least. And so what I see your paper as, and congratulations too for discovering this and working on the research of others, of course, is that it has given Jerusalem archaeologists, Jerusalem historical people that look back at the archaeology and history of Jerusalem, a new tool to then think about what the city looked like from the biblical period of the biblical kings. Is there anything that you came across that you feel like, every time you come forward with a new theory, and I would say one as dramatic as this, where you're saying that there all the evidence does align to this scene being Jerusalem, is there any cause for hesitation in your mind? Have you been able, as there are others that have come and pushed back, and you had to kind of overcome some of their questions regarding your designation?
The chief competing theory was that this city on Sa'd 28 was Eltekeh. So Eltekeh, the reason for this is because there's no break in the image between that battle with the Egyptians and the Sa'd 28 city. And so it had been argued that, and that was kind of the leading theory before this, that the city was the city of Eltekeh on whose lands this battle was fought. And what I showed in the paper is that frequently Assyrian artists use what's called continuous narrative, where they would show events, narrative events unfolding across a long scene. These were very long scenes often, and show them progressing chronologically without having, they didn't have panel breaks like we do in our cartoons today or in our images today. So they would just continue along. And so one scene, we've got 12 panels of them traveling along a river. They come to a city, they conquer the city, they loot and count heads and so on after the conquest west of the city. They travel the next city, they conquer that city, the third city, and then later didn't draw the rest of it. And so
And this is in a
that
different, this is a different example in a different
this is
room.
a different room, but it gives you an example of how they depicted things, how
Okay.
their narratives worked. So all of that was one unbroken image. So then when we look at this and we see these two scenes that are unbroken, it doesn't mean that this has to be at the exact same time as this and the exact same place as this. It just means that we're seeing two different events from the same campaign, from the same journey. And he actually shows that in similar to that other scene, what happened between the two scenes of the battle and the city is just the Assyrian army traveling.
Okay.
And what I showed in the paper is that there's a small city, you can probably put this up, on the hill in the back of the Egyptian camp. The Egyptians have positioned themselves between the city and the battle as if protecting it, which I believe is Eltekeh. And Eltekeh was not an important city. We don't have it mentioned elsewhere besides just the Joshua lists of, naming all the cities. But it doesn't, and in this particular account, because their land happened to be where the two
To the armies
enemies
met.
met. Yeah, exactly. Whereas the Slab 28 city was enormous, multiple gates, large city, featured to the right of the throne. It actually continued onto Slab 29 as well, which was lost. That kind of feature in the throne room would not have been Slab. Eltekeh was not worthy of that kind of. In addition to which, Eltekeh was destroyed, whereas the city's shown with the Assyrian army leaving it and leaving it intact. So I think there's no question that if you understand how the continuous narrative works elsewhere in the palace, that these are two separate scenes, and that this cannot be Eltekeh, and that Eltekeh is that little city in the back of the battle that the Egyptians are protecting from the Philistines or from the Assyrians.
So just one final thing. I do think it's interesting. There have been others that have come before you, one in particular that has said that this scene could have been Jerusalem. And just the methodology, I think, of the prior research compared to yours, was different. And I think that's important as well. Perhaps you could just speak to how you came across the Jerusalem image.
So Christoph Willinger did a study specifically looking for Jerusalem inside Sennacherib's palace, and he came up with a few different candidates. This was a leading candidate. He also put forward the Eltekeh theory as a possibility, which dates to Russell, and he also spent some time discussing the possibility that it simply wasn't depicted in the palace. And his conclusion was that there just wasn't enough information. It may not have been depicted in the palace at all. If so, we're not sure where. But credit to him for the being the first one to entertain the idea that this could be Jerusalem. And I kind of kept going with that. I think I found enough additional information, such as understanding the continuous narrative, such as the Judean architectural style, and so on.
And the fact that you weren't actually looking for Jerusalem on this slab, you were busy trying to find your long lost Phoenician city.
That was where it all started, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you so much for your work again. If people want to access this, it's the article's entitled "Sennacherib's Throne Room Reliefs on Jerusalem and the Misplaced City of Ushu." It was published in the October 2025 Journal of Near Eastern Studies, a journal published by the University of Chicago. Stephen Compton, thank you very much for your research, and thank you very much for sharing with us today.
Thank you so much, Brent. Thanks for everything. And thank you also for, you played a little bit of an active role in this. We had a great, helpful discussion after ASO when I first presented this that helped me improve the paper a lot. And so
Yeah,
I
well, I will
appreciate it.
say honestly, when I saw this image, you can probably remember my visceral reaction, because I was in the Jerusalem room presenting at ASO on the Phoenician pendant, gold pendant that we discovered in the Ophel. And so I was speaking the same time you were speaking, so I missed your presentation. And then we met up and I had not seen this image at all. And then as soon as I saw it, somebody, I think this reaction is going to take place on many individuals that see this for the first time that have studied the architecture and archaeology of ancient Jerusalem. And it will be just light bulbs going off. In an unconstrained manner for some time. So I
Excellent.
really appreciate you might not have been in the field of Jerusalem archaeology at the time, but you're quickly inspiring us whose heads have been in it for a long time. So again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Brett. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Stephen Compton for that. Again, if you want to follow up on this, you can read the scientific paper that was published in the Journal of Near Eastern Studies. I'll leave a link for that in the show notes. And I'll leave a link also to our magazine as well, where you can read the PDF online straight away. You can go to the article straight away. You can look at images of this depiction of Jerusalem inside Sennacherib's throne room. If you do want to receive our magazine, go to armstronginstitute.org, scroll down, you'll find a place to enter your mailing address. And then you can also write an email to letters@armstronginstitute.org and put your mailing address there. We'll make sure we sign you up for your year's subscription to our magazine. Thanks very much for watching. Don't forget to like and subscribe if you liked the interview today, and so that you don't miss more of our content from the Institute.